From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, challenging the medical bureaucracy, we talk with AIDS activist Martin Delaney. Many consider him a hero in the war on AIDS. He has smuggled in AIDS drugs from other countries, drugs that haven't been approved in the United States. And he's helped reform the government's procedure for testing new drugs. Also, can your employer cut back your health insurance after you've gotten sick and put a financial cap on your illness? That's the question in a case that may be headed toward the Supreme Court. The lawsuit was filed by a man with AIDS after his employer changed to a policy that put a $5,000 cap on AIDS-related expenses. We'll talk with lawyers representing both sides. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Attorney General William Barr named his own special investigator to look into the administration's handling of a bank scandal involving billions of dollars in illegal loans to Iraq. Today's action fell short of demands by congressional Democrats. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
Attorney General Barr has named retired U.S. District Judge Frederick B. Lacey of New Jersey to head up the investigation into whether the Justice Department and the CIA misled prosecutors in Atlanta. If Barr thought his actions would calm political passions, he was wrong. David Boren, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said Barr's appointment is not a satisfactory substitute for an independent counsel appointed by the court. Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore said Barr had taken a half step when a full step is needed. Asked repeatedly why he had decided to appoint his own investigator, Barr said there is still no evidence high-level officials have done anything wrong. He insisted that Judge Lacey will have a totally free hand and said the appointment of Lacey does not preclude the appointment of a court-named special prosecutor down the road. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A Guatemalan woman won the 1992 Nobel Peace Prize today. Indian leader Rigoberta Menchu was awarded a $1.2 million check, a diploma, and a gold medal. The Nobel Committee said Menchu was a vivid symbol of peace and reconciliation across ethnic, cultural, and social lines. Menchu is a human rights activist now living in Mexico. She lost her parents and a brother in the struggle against the Guatemalan military. The Guatemalan government said it recognizes Menchu's efforts for better economic and political conditions for indigenous peoples. The South African government today proposed a broad amnesty that would grant immunity from prosecution to police and government officials who committed crimes in the name of enforcing apartheid. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The government proposal, expected to win parliamentary approval next week, would require those seeking protection to confess to a special amnesty review commission. Confessions would be kept confidential, even if serious crimes such as murder were involved. The government says the amnesty is needed to protect officials from retribution by a future black majority government. The African National Congress, the leading black opposition movement, says the amnesty amounts to the government granting itself a pardon for the repressions of apartheid. ANC officials have vowed that they will not honor the amnesty if they eventually take power in democratic elections. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
A Navy reserve plane crashed during training exercises today into the Gulf of Mexico. Its two crew members ejected safely. Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 0.27 points. This is NPR News. Environmental Protection Agency officials say smog levels have gone down in many cities, largely due to this year's cooler weather. The EPA releases its air quality report next week. It shows that 41 cities no longer violate federal smog standards. But the EPA says 56 urban areas still have too much ozone, a component of smog. That means nearly 70 million people are breathing unhealthy air. The Boeing company says it is still reviewing the latest statement out of the Netherlands concerning the probable cause of the October 4th crash of a Boeing cargo plane. The lead Dutch investigator announced at a news conference today that metal fatigue in the engine supports is the most likely cause of the crash. Ann Martin of member station KPLU reports from Seattle.
At first, Dutch officials thought fuse pins which attach engines to the wings might be the cause of the jumbo jet crash. Now, however, investigators are turning their attention on the pylons or struts that hold engines to the wing. But Boeing spokesman Bill Curry says the comment of a Dutch investigator today at a news conference needs to be taken in context.
Our understanding is that the metal fatigue comment was put forth as a hypothesis, as opposed to a definitive finding.
Meanwhile, the Federal Aviation Administration plans to respond to the Dutch investigators' concerns early next week with information it has gathered on metal fatigue and corrosion of the 747s. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Martin in Seattle.
In the Ukrainian capital Kiev today, riot police blocked a protest march toward the parliament building. More than 1,000 students demonstrated, calling for political reform. One student was arrested. A student leader says several protesters suffered minor injuries when police hit them. The students chanted "down with the president" and threw eggs and tomatoes at police. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Martin Delaney has been described as part of an informal brain trust of AIDS activists that is changing the face of research into AIDS and other life-threatening illnesses. Delaney isn't from an activist background. He was at home in the corporate world and worked as a consultant to the Bank of America. Then his lover got AIDS. Delaney had heard about drugs that weren't yet approved in America but had showed favorable results in other countries. So he smuggled drugs from Mexico for his lover. Soon Delaney was smuggling in AIDS drugs for other people, and he became active in the AIDS underground. In 1985, he founded Project Inform to disseminate the latest information on AIDS drugs and to find ways to speed up the clinical testing process. Delaney is the subject of a new book called Acceptable Risks. Delaney's first experience with clinical drug testing came before the AIDS epidemic when he had hepatitis and was administered an experimental drug. He learned several lessons from the experience.
One of the first lessons was the one of recognizing risks versus benefits, that there are trade-offs, that there's no magic solutions, which give only benefit and no downside. But I think it's important to understand that and go in and choose the risk if you choose to do so, rather than blindly assume that the drug you're going to take is going to be wonderful. So that was the first one. But I think the bigger lesson to me was more in what happened afterward, when I saw the treatments really have a potentially very good effect for me. And then because of the side effects, see the system, as I saw it, bring that study essentially to a conclusion and no longer pursue that avenue of research. And watching that happen immediately struck me that there was something wrong here, that why were bureaucrats in Washington making this decision about whether people like me could or couldn't have access to that therapy?
When your lover got AIDS in 1984, you went to Tijuana to smuggle out an experimental drug. What led you to do that?
Well, it really wasn't as crazy as it might have sounded. It was partly my own experience of knowing that fighting back helped, whether it was a drug or the spirit of it. I didn't have much of a concern, but I knew that sitting back and passively accepting what was coming was not going to work. You know, what doctors told people in those days was, there are no treatments, let's just wait and see. Well, you know, wait and see in this disease always meant one thing. It meant death. So we went down there, not just out of craziness. It's not like running to a Tijuana cancer clinic. What we went down there for were drugs that the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health had already stated in many public forums might have real potential for the disease, and that they were anxiously trying to move forward with studies for those drugs. Well, to me, it was a no-brainer at that point for anyone who was sick to say, at least there's a reasonable chance here that these are going to be useful. They have the attention of the scientists and the researchers. They show activity in the laboratory, and you, in fact, can get them. You just had to go to a little trouble to do it.
Were you and your lover a little nervous about taking an experimental drug in an unsupervised setting?
I'd have to say no. That may sound a little arrogant, but As adults, I think the public is a lot more capable than it may give itself credit for to make choices about things like that and to take things. This was not an unknown drug. It was on sale. One of them was sold in 20 countries, the other in more than 100 countries. And we're in wide, relatively common use. And, the human testing had been done. The dosages were known. The safety and toxicities were well described. So it really wasn't a stab in the dark in that sense.
Let's talk about the two aspects of the work that you've been doing, the bringing in of experimental drugs from other countries and your attempts to change the way experimental drugs are tested in a clinical setting. Why don't we start with the smuggling? When you started smuggling drugs, was it hard to think of yourself as a smuggler?
Well, I must say I don't even to this day ever think of it as having been smuggling. Smuggling has all these connotations of profit-making illegal activity. I never felt that that's what we were doing. I felt that we were perhaps in some cases stretching the definition of the law. But it was so clear to us that people needed and wanted access to these things that we had to do it. So I did feel funny, though. You may see in some of the scenes in the book where I'm down in Tijuana tearing my car apart and stuffing things in, where I began to feel a little bit like a criminal in the sense this is the kind of stuff you hear of cocaine smugglers and other folks doing. But this wasn't, illicit pleasure drugs I was dealing with here. These were, life-saving medications. And it made me angry to think that I was going through that. And one particular incident in the book was so very striking on that, where I had to make a very rapid trip down there. I had to tear the car apart and stuff thousands of pills into the car, put it back together, and in the process really tore my hands up physically, which is why I remember it so distinctly. And then, driving back 9 hours nonstop through the middle of the night and getting home at, 5 o'clock in the morning. And as I came pulling over the bridge into San Francisco as the sun was coming up, I thought, my God, what the hell am I doing here? This is what I'm doing with my weekends. I realized that we were into something a little more dramatic than I had intended. And it was in a sort of a mental crossover point for me that said we were really on a campaign at that point.
When you were buying drugs that were not yet approved in the United States and you were buying them in large quantities from foreign sources, did they know what you were up to?
Well, sure. They knew that we were buying them for other people. And I was hardly the only one doing this at this point. There were literally thousands of people coming down to Tijuana, Mexico on weekends for a long period back in that era. Most of them would go just to bring it for themselves or one or two friends, but there were so many people who were incapable of traveling, whether for economic reasons or for health reasons. And I think the stores understood that we were supplying them on to other people. There was never any question about that.
One more question on the issue of bringing in experimental mm-hmm. drugs that aren't approved yet in the United States. How necessary do you think that still is?
Well, it is less so than in 1984 and 85 when this began. And I think that's really a valid question, because back in those days, there was no alternative. There was no AZT. There were no drugs of any kind that your physician could make available. So at that point, it was not only a legitimate option, it was the only option. Now, today, there is less of a need for that because there are some, potentially useful drugs that are sold and available through the doctors. But not everything still falls into that category. And in some cases, useful drugs that are coming along through the pipeline are not available early enough, although we hope that even that problem is now solved, but we won't know for sure for a while. So today, I think there is less of that on a large scale, but I wouldn't want to suggest that closes it out. For example, if a really promising new drug should appear in Europe, and I can think of some where that might well be the case, I think that this underground network will act just as it had before to make sure that people have access to things as quickly as they need it.
My guest is AIDS activist Martin Delaney, founder of the group Project Inform. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Delaney. He's the subject of a new book called Acceptable Risks.
Now let's talk about the other aspect of the work that you've done, which is working on clinical testing and trying to reform the ways that drugs are clinically tested and approved in the United States. You've been trying to streamline and speed up the process and make experimental drugs that might be useful more available. What were your problems early on when you got involved in this with the clinical testing as it was being done?
Well, in those days, clinical research existed really in a vacuum. It was in many ways, a theoretical science, very academic and intended to be very precise in ways that sort of objectified the patient, that the patient was a research subject rather than a person. And that was true both on the research end and on the regulatory side, insofar as the regulatory agencies, the FDA and that, in the early days, didn't want contact with people with AIDS. They felt that they had to be the objective gatekeeper and didn't want to be swayed by these emotional factors that come, you know, that come in your face literally when a patient is there. So one of the first things I think that we had to accomplish was to humanize the research, to make sure the researchers saw their patients as human beings, made sure the regulatory agencies saw that, and began to act accordingly. And I think that was truly the first hurdle that we had to conquer, and did so just by bringing patients to them and by bringing them to the patients one-on-one and then groups upon groups. We pressed intensively with them to imagine that this wasn't a bunch of undesirable homosexuals or drug users, put them in our shoes and say, you know, what if this were your wife or your daughter or your son or your mother or your father? Would you act the same way? Would you believe the same thing? Because, in fact, the same problems do affect the wives and the mothers and the sons and the husbands and the daughters. The same problems affect people with cancer, with Alzheimer's disease, with any kind of life-threatening illness. These are the same issues.
What were your feelings and what are your feelings now about placebo testing for people who have AIDS? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad you phrased it the way you did, because placebo testing as a generic subject might be different from placebo testing in AIDS. The obvious purpose of placebo testing is to compare a known drug or an unknown drug, a new drug, against a placebo, an inert substance, and then measure the effects of the inert substance versus the real one. And the hope is that you get very precise information in that fashion. Now, that makes sense scientifically, but is it morally acceptable to do that when someone's lives may be lost as a consequence of it? Is it fair to ask those people to run the risk of sacrificing the last 6 months of their life in order to receive a placebo and perhaps to get good information that for people that follow after them? That's always the argument. We would argue today that in most instances, the uses of placebos and AIDS is unacceptable. And I say it for several reasons. One, because we do have useful drugs, not perfect drugs, but there are useful drugs out there. And I think there are very few circumstances in which it would be legitimate to deny patients access to those drugs while putting them on a placebo. The other reason I question it, having now watched many, many of these trials, is that I think the doctrine or academic belief about placebo trials being so precise and producing such valid answers, I think is a myth. I think that the placebo testing process itself is riddled with the psychological and methodological problems that prevent it from doing what they think it does. So that being the case, I think you have to put the ethical and human needs first.
You've made the argument to the medical profession that people have been cheating in these experimental drug tests anyways, people with AIDS, because they want to make sure that they're not on a placebo. In what ways have people been cheating?
Well, especially in the early years of the studies, there was a sort of an esprit de corps among patients in some of the studies where they would come out of the day when the drugs were distributed, some of which were placebos, some of which were real drugs, and there were scenes we heard of where people would pour all the drugs in a bowl and everybody would then scoop out their share, not knowing what came out in the mix, sort of sharing the risk in that sense. In other cases, we know for a fact that quite a number of people sent drugs out to be tested on their own to find out what it was. And
tested in a lab.
Yeah, tested in a laboratory, yeah, to determine what it was, and then to drop out if it's the placebo. And still others, for example, in AZT trials, there are some very obvious changes that occur in a patient's blood work as a consequence of one of the side effects of the drug, and it's real easy to pick that out. So that's part of the argument that we made, is that to the physicians, was you're not getting the clean information you think you are out of these placebo-based trials. What you're getting is a lot of desperate people under extraordinary circumstances who will do whatever they feel they need to save their own lives. So we argued, instead of doing that, let's put the trials in a different way. Let's let people who truly and desperately need access to these promising drugs, let them have that access in some parallel fashion. And then let's recruit people into the clinical trials, not so much out of desperation, but for other reasons. And therefore, you get people who are better quality research subjects. For example, there are many legitimate other reasons to join a trial other than the desperate search for a new drug. Many people join trials to get better medical quality care. Some people join them to get any medical care at all. Some people join it just to get the cost of the drugs taken care of, or extra laboratory tests. And some people do it just simply for altruistic reasons. So I think by getting people in for those reasons, as opposed to this desperate, last-minute search for a magical cure, you get a better quality of research subject, and in the end, you get better quality data as a consequence. And that argument ultimately prevailed with the National Institutes of Health and the FDA in the form of a system we now call the Parallel Track Access Program.
You want to explain that?
Sure. This is a program originally created by AIDS activists in 1989, myself included. Mostly it was our group and the treatment and data group of ACT UP New York that was involved in the creation of that. And what it does is it says that when we're working with a new drug that shows some evidence of value, not when it's totally new, but when we've got some evidence that of its safety and that it's active in a useful way, we go ahead and set those studies up, but outside of the studies, we create a separate but parallel track for people who have desperate medical need for that drug, and we let them have it in some kind of a monitored fashion, but we let them have access outside that. So those people who can join the trial and want to join the trial, they do so. That's how they get the drug. But those who have this desperate personal need get it on the parallel track instead. And that's now been done with several drugs, and we think with great success. In particular, the drug DDI was handled in that fashion, and 25,000 people got it on the parallel track system. 2,000 got it in the clinical trials. And in the end, it worked out well for everybody. The clinical trials got the data that they needed from legitimate patients who weren't there solely out of desperation. And the people who had that desperation factor and that tremendous need got the drug in the parallel track. And some useful data came out of both of them, and the drug was then approved quite speedily.
How do you think that your relationship with the medical establishment and the medical bureaucracy has changed in the past few years?
Well, that's, again, a good question. At this point, it depends on how you define it, too. Our relationships with the highest levels of the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration and the research community, those relationships are very, very good at this point. I think they have come to see that that many of the AIDS activists have developed a great deal of knowledge about this and are skillful and helpful in working with them. So in that sense, we're no longer the radical outsiders that we once were, and that even causes problems in the community sometimes. I think we've sold out, and all I can say is we haven't changed a bit. The system has changed to accommodate our viewpoints. Now, but if we define this, the medical establishment, in a different way, you get a different answer. If you define it as doctors, primary care physicians out there in the world treating patients, then the relationships are actually somewhat strained for a lot of reasons. I think there's some resentment of the access that we have to the top researchers. There's some uncomfortable situations that occur because we often get the best medical information earlier than they do, and that can cause conflict between them and their patients. So in that sense, I think we still put a lot of doctors and clinicians on edge who probably still assume that we're some kind of radical troublemakers who don't understand the system but somehow have access to the big shots. But we're trying to fix that.
One of the things the AIDS Underground has been criticized for, even by fellow AIDS activists, is the chance that your pressure on the drug industries to speed up testing and on the medical mm-hmm. establishments to speed up testing will help erode standards of testing that consumer activists work really, really long and hard to put into effect. Mm-hmm. And it might play into the hands of the drug industry, which wants to get drugs approved and on the market as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an important question that needs to be responded to. If you look at what we've actually done here, I think we've taken every possible precaution to prevent that from happening. What this is really all about is the interplay of two different needs within society. On the one hand, there's the need you describe, the need to be protected from unsafe and ineffective drugs, and everybody agrees with that need. But the other need, which is equally legitimate, is the need of life-threatened people to have the earliest possible access to those things that might help them live. And those needs, they sort of butt up against each other. And where I think we've been successful is in weaving a pattern of regulation that accommodates both of those, that says, no, there isn't one immutable standard anymore, and we think there shouldn't be. There should be a strong, very conservative standard for the non-essential medical treatments, the headache pills and the hypertension. There's 1,000 categories of drugs out there that are good to have but not essential at any given moment in time. But there's this other category of drugs that are essential for people with a life-threatening illness, be it AIDS or cancers or Alzheimer's, whatever it happens to be. It is for those drugs and those patients that the standards have been changed, and in a way that is that ultimately doesn't diminish the standard. It simply changes the timing of approval of those drugs. For example, with drugs like DDI and DDC that have recently been approved, they were put on the market before all of the long-term studies were in. And one could say, well, the standard's been changed there. But in fact, part of that approval included the demand that those same traditional long-term studies be completed in a timely fashion after the approval. And at the end of that time, if it turns out that the drugs weren't as good as we thought or had some hidden problems, they're going to be yanked right off the market. So ultimately, the standard is preserved. What's changed is the moment of access for the people whose lives are in jeopardy.
Has your work as an AIDS activist politicized you in a broader way too?
Well, certainly in the sense of government policies and practices, it has. I remain appalled and angry at the lack of attention to this problem that we've had from the last two administrations. There's just no question about that. It bothers me that why should I, as it's clear in the book, why should I, a business person with no particular investment in this, why did I end up in this situation? Why did I end up in Mexico scraping my knuckles apart, sticking drugs into cars? And I'm one of many people who's had to do this kind of stuff. Why? Because we didn't have an administration in Washington who took this problem seriously, because these issues could have been driven directly from Washington if we had some real leadership.
Martin Delaney, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Delaney is the founder of Project Inform. He's the subject of the new book, Acceptable Risks, by Jonathan Quitney. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. These are times when people live in fear of losing their health insurance. Now there is a case that challenges an employer's right to change insurance plans and put a financial cap on your illness after you've gotten sick. The suit was filed by Jack McGann, whose employer changed its insurance plan after McGann got AIDS. The Supreme Court has been asked to hear the case, but today the Bush administration recommended against it. Coming up, we'll talk to lawyers from both sides. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush today renewed his attack on Democrat Bill Clinton's character. He accused the Arkansas governor of a pattern of deception on his military draft record. Mr. Bush was in New Jersey today. He said that his campaign will surprise the pundits and hit a home run on Election Day. Meanwhile, dozens of Clinton supporters at the New Jersey rally held up anti-Bush signs, including ones that read, quote, Bush lies. The president called those protesters, quote, pathetic draft dodgers. Governor Bill Clinton spent the day after the second presidential debate in Virginia and Louisiana. NPR's Mara Liasson reports his campaign now has to guard against overconfidence.
Clinton was pleased with his performance last night. The live audience format was expected to work to his advantage. Instant polls taken after the debate showed that it had. Clinton aides described the mood in the campaign as euphoric. Two young staffers joked that instead of playing rock music at his rallies, the campaign should use Hail to the Chief. But campaign officials are warning against overconfidence. At a rally at the state capitol in Richmond this morning, Clinton told voters to stay with him because it's not over till it's over. Later in the afternoon, Clinton traveled to Louisiana, where he met up with a Get Out the Vote effort focused on increasing black turnout. Appearing at Southern University in Baton Rouge with members of the Congressional Black Caucus and Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards. In Baton Rouge, I'm Mara Liasson.
German police have arrested three suspects of smuggling 4.5 pounds of highly enriched uranium from the former Soviet Union into Germany. Dieter Berger reports.
Police found the container in a highway parking lot near Munich. A state prosecutor said initial investigations indicate the uranium is of a sufficiently enriched grade to be used in nuclear weapons. One German and two Czechs were arrested. Law officials have not yet determined the origin of the enriched uranium, but suspect it stems from the former Soviet Union. German authorities say they have uncovered more than 100 cases this year of illegal trade in nuclear materials from Eastern Europe. Police arrested five people in Frankfurt last weekend after discovering small amounts of cesium-137 and strontium-90 in metal containers in the downtown area. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The government says that exports dropped at the fastest pace in 5 years during August, and industrial production fell again in September. The Commerce Department says the drop in exports widened 24% in August to $9 billion. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve says that industrial production dropped for a second straight month in September and that U.S. factories operated at their slowest rate in half a year. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials lost just over a quarter of a point to end the day at 3,174.41. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. NASA says a planned November shuttle mission will be delayed by a week because of a failed component in the craft's orbital maneuvering system. The military mission was supposed to take off in mid-November, but liftoff is now set for no earlier than November 25th. Technicians will remove Discovery's left orbital maneuvering system next week. Engineers have yet to decide whether to put in a new one or repair the original. A Florida judge has ruled that two children abandoned by their adoptive parents in the wake of Hurricane Andrew may stay with their foster parents. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
Shortly after Hurricane Andrew swept through South Florida, Gary and Alma Knight left their adopted children and their belongings on the doorstep of a state office building. The Knights said the hurricane's devastation to their home and business left them in such turmoil they were unable to care for the children. Today, a Miami juvenile judge agreed that the youngsters would be better off in foster care, despite pleas by the state to keep the family together. Officials with the Florida Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services asked the judge to give the Knights more time to work with counselors and reconsider. But attorneys for both the parents and children said their minds were made up and there's no hope for reconciliation. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
The Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation says the average 30-year rate for a mortgage rose to 8.06% this week. That's up from last week's rate of 8.01%. The corporation says the average interest rate for a 15-year fixed loan also increased to just over 7.5%. The British government cut interest rates by a full percentage point today to 8%. The move was a surprise since the Bank of England recently signaled that another cut wasn't likely in the immediate future. The government was reportedly stung by charges that it isn't giving the country firm leadership to end a painful recession. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Can your employer cut back your health insurance after you've gotten sick and then put a financial cap on your particular illness? Well, that's the question behind the case we're about to discuss. In 1987, Jack McGann got AIDS. After he filed his first claim with his employer, H&H Music, in Houston, the company changed its insurance plan and put a financial cap on AIDS-related expenses. McGann sued. He lost, appealed, and lost again. Now the case may be headed for the Supreme Court. But today, the Bush administration urged the court not to hear the case. How are McGann's medical benefits changed? After he got AIDS, his company decided to become self-insured. Under a federal law, companies that are self-insured are exempt from state insurance regulations, including those which prohibit caps on specific diseases. When McGann got sick, he was insured for $1 million over the course of a lifetime. But under his company's new policy, there was a $5,000 cap on AIDS-related expenses. McGann died over a year ago, and for the record, I should tell you he was a friend of mine. We're going to hear from lawyers representing both sides of this case. First, Suzanne Goldberg of the Lambda Legal Defense Fund, who is representing McGann's estate. I asked her to explain how McGann's policy was changed after he got sick.
Well, basically, H&H Music had $1 million lifetime coverage for all of its employees through a traditional health insurance program. And that's a plan where a typical plan where an employer pays insurance premiums for its employee to an outside insurer. When Jack McGann informed his employer that he had AIDS, the company decided it would shift to a self-insured plan. That means that the company may continue with an insurance plan administrator, but really the company funds the health coverage itself. When it made that change, the company decided to keep its $1 million lifetime coverage, but cap benefits for AIDS-related treatments at $5,000. The difference between a traditional insurance plan and a self-insured plan is that a self-insured plan is not subject to state regulation. What that means in the case, what that meant in the case of Jack McGann is that the new plan was not subject to state laws which prohibited discrimination against people with HIV, state laws that prohibited AIDS benefit caps.
So let me see if I get this straight. The employee got AIDS, and after submitting a claim, then the company decided to switch policies to become self-insured, and that meant that it could cap the benefits for AIDS because companies that are self-insured are not subjected to state regulations.
That's right. Really, the only reason it seems that H&H Music shifted from a traditional to a self-insured plan was to avoid state regulations that would have prohibited it from imposing a cap on AIDS-related benefits.
What did the company tell McGann about their reasons for changing to self-insured?
The company admitted that it changed to self-insured to avoid paying the costs of McGann's care for his treatments for HIV disease. Jack McGann had worked for the company since 1982. In late 1987, he went into the hospital, found he had pneumonia, and received an AIDS diagnosis. In early 1988, He told his company that he had AIDS and submitted his first claims. 2 months later, the company called a meeting with McGann and the insurance company to discuss McGann's illness. And 4 months after that, the company announced that it was shifting insurance plans and now was offering a new plan, a self-insured plan, that kept the old $1 million lifetime coverage for all illnesses except for HIV disease.
Is this happening to a lot of people, that they're employed by a company and the company changes its policy after you've gotten sick and suddenly your insurance isn't what you thought it was?
Well, that's exactly the problem. We at Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, who represent McGann, are getting calls from all around the country from people who have AIDS, who file a claim with their employer, and then find that their employer is changing the coverage to exclude them from a plan. Of course, this isn't only happening to people with AIDS and HIV disease. It is also happening to people with a range of other illnesses that an employer somehow deems are too expensive to be covered. And then the employer writes those people out of the plan. It really strikes at the vulnerability of all employees who are covered under self-insured plans.
Now, explain some more what a self-insured plan is, and how do you know if your company has one?
Well, the easiest way to know if your company has one is to go back and look at at your insurance policy. It will say in your policy what type of plan you're covered under. Your policy will also tell you the rights under that plan. 65% of all Americans who receive insurance through their employer are now covered by self-insured plans. Most large employers have shifted from traditional insurance plans to self-insured plans. Some of them have shifted, they say, to save costs. Others, like the company in this case, really shifted to avoid paying the costs of care for a specific employee.
I guess, an employer can certainly make the argument that AIDS-related medical expenses would drive them out of business because it costs so much money. Did H&H Music make that claim?
Sure they did, and there are a couple of important points to keep in mind regarding that claim. One is that the reasoning for, in terms of cutting out a person with AIDS as opposed to cutting out a person with HIV, as opposed to cutting out a person with, say, cancer or some other disease, isn't based on any kind of sound actuarial principle. The truth is that lifetime treatment for care of a person with AIDS is about $85,000. The cost of care for a person with breast cancer is usually estimated about $50,000 to $60,000. Cost of care for a person with a liver transplant is $145,000. For a premature baby can be above $500,000. So when a company says that it's cutting out a person with HIV disease to save costs, it seems clear that underlying that is an intent to discriminate against people with AIDS. Also, if a company is truly interested in saving costs, there's absolutely no basis for cutting out a specific disease, and in this case, a specific worker, from a plan. If a company wants to save costs, it can cut costs across the board.
So you are suing for discrimination?
Yes, we're suing under a provision of the federal law that prohibits an employer from interfering with an employee who claims a right under a plan. We're arguing that the employer here promised $1 million worth of lifetime coverage and did not change that promise until Jack McGann tried to make a claim on it. What this really means is that an employer is trying to make a promise and then, when called to pay on that promise, isn't doing so.
You know, it just makes you wonder, isn't the premise of all insurance that you pay them money when something goes wrong, they pay you? It's kind of scary to think that the insurer can renege on that promise.
That's absolutely right. Really, what this case shows is that all workers are vulnerable, because the courts, in upholding the employer's decision to cap benefits, have effectively said that, employer, you can promise your employees anything, and when it comes time to pay, you don't really have to do so.
Suzanne Goldberg is a lawyer with the Lambda Legal Defense Fund. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is lawyer Suzanne Goldberg.
Your case is being supported by the National Governors Association, the American Medical Association, and the American Association of Retired Persons. What's the connection with the American Association of Retired Persons?
They care, as we do, about the vulnerability of all people who are covered under self-insured plans. The AARP recognizes that while this case excluded a person with AIDS from a plan, the court's decision also means that any employer can now exclude any person or any disease from a plan. And this clearly strikes at the needs of so many of the AARP's members who are covered under insurance plans from employers.
Well, you know, something that really confuses me about this whole suit is why are employers who have their own insurance companies exempt from state regulations?
Their philosophy, or the philosophy of the federal government behind exempting employers from state regulation, is that if an employer is national, the federal government wanted to avoid a situation where an employer would be liable for a patchwork of different types of regulations from across the country. In other words, if the state of Texas requires one thing and the state of Massachusetts requires another and the state of New York requires a third, the federal government wanted to avoid making employers have to comply with 50 different types of regulations.
And there's no federal regulation that prevents an employer with a self-insurance policy from putting a cap on one specific disease.
There has been no federal regulation to prevent that. We are trying to argue in this case that there should be, and that there is, and that that law exists, and that the courts below simply misinterpreted that law, and that decision must be overruled. There is also the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has come into effect, and we will be arguing that the ADA, as it's known, does prohibit caps on a specific disease in an insurance plan.
Do you see this suit as just being an example of how healthcare costs and health insurance are just kind of out of control in our country now?
This suit really highlights the problems of the healthcare system in this country today. The most significant aspect of this suit is it shows how vulnerable all workers under self-insured plans are. You know, of course, rising healthcare costs play a role in causing employers to shift from traditional to self-insured plans, with employers thinking that somehow they're going to save some money. But the truth is that the costs have to be covered somewhere or other. Partly, costs should, of course, be kept down, and partly, the federal government has really not taken any responsibility over the last 12 years in developing a system that will better address the health care needs of this society. So now we have people who do not have access to health care suffering as a result of the absence, virtual absence, of a decent federal health care system, and employers who say, why us? Why should we bear the burden of costs of national health care? Under the system that the federal administration has been pushing for the last many years, the responsibility for health care in this country has supposedly been divided between the public and private sectors. The truth is, under the decision in this case, the private sector has yet another way to get out of taking that part of its responsibility. One reason why groups like the National Governors Association and the U.S. Conference of Mayors are so interested in the outcome of the case is that it is the cities and states which ultimately wind up bearing the bulk of the burden for health care costs, especially when private employers can exclude from its plans coverage of people who have certain so-called expensive diseases, which then leaves the cities and states to pick up the tab.
Suzanne Goldberg is representing the estate of Jack McGann. Coming up, we'll hear from the lawyer representing McGann's former employer. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, you reported from the debate last night. What will you have on that today?
Debate day plus one, Terry. We have our correspondents from the campaign trail, Mara Lyson and Elizabeth Arnold, reporting in on what the campaigns thought happened and what happens next. Also, we're going to talk to some of the people who were there to ask questions, the undecided voters, three Republicans who will tell us what the debate made them think they want to do, a little commentary on political cats, a report on the economy of the state of Washington, and a conversation with the author of a children's book called Sign of the Seahorse.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're talking about health insurance and a case that challenges an employer's right to put a financial cap on coverage of your disease after you've gotten sick. My guest Mark Huvert is representing H&H Music in Houston in a suit filed by an employee with AIDS. I asked Huvert what the rationale was when the company changed the health insurance plan after the employee, Jack McGann, got sick.
I think their rationale was to try and preserve as much of the medical benefits that they could provide their employees as possible and provide the broadest range of benefits. Mr. McGann's benefits, or the benefit for AIDS, wasn't the only thing that was cut. There was a cap put on what I understand to be one of the more expensive items, which is mental and nervous disorders, and treatment for drug and alcohol abuse was eliminated entirely, so that there was no benefit payable for that. The plan, in the year prior to the plan change, for every dollar it took in, it spent a dollar and a half. So I think the fair rationale was to try and save money so that the money that was available, that the company was chipping in toward payment of premiums and to have the coverage, was to have as great a benefit as possible for the greatest number of people.
AIDS is a life-threatening illness. Is it discrimination to put a cap on AIDS and not put a cap on other life-threatening illnesses that are also very expensive, like kidney disease or cancer or heart attacks?
I guess I would ask you to define discrimination. What's really gone unsaid in this case, and nobody's really talked about it, although the Fifth Circuit in deciding the case talked about it a little bit, was what is the rationale? The only rationale that H&H was ever accused of for using and making the determination to cap the benefit for AIDS was to save money. Certainly, they chose different benefit levels for various items, various illnesses. I guess you could argue that drug and alcohol abuse is an illness, and it is life-threatening. The problem with saying, is it discrimination, it implies that there's something more going on than just trying to save money because a particular disease or category of diseases is very costly to a plan. I don't think Mr. McGann ever made the allegation that the company was treating him in a discriminatory manner in terms of other conditions of his employment or that somehow the company had a personal dislike for him. The allegation in his complaint, and in fact through all the proceedings, was it's not right because they're trying to save money. Well, that's pretty obvious that the company was trying to save money due to the cost of the disease. And so if you're going to ask the question, is it discrimination, you have to define, I think, what you mean by discrimination. I mean, are you asking me, does the company not like people with AIDS? I think the answer to that is that I don't think it matters to the company so long as the employee is able to do a good job.
There's always a gamble in insurance. And the gamble is, you know, if you're well or if your house doesn't burn down, then maybe you didn't need the insurance. But, you know, you're paying this money or whatever, and when you do get sick or when your house does burn down, you're insured. And you just wonder, like, what about the insurer's end of that bargain? Does this mean that if the house burns down or if you get AIDS, that they could decide, whoops, it's too expensive, we don't really want to cover it, so we'll kind of change the policy?
Well, I understand your question. The problem is, in the context of our case, it's not really applicable. And from this standpoint, H&H Music Company is in the music business. It provided insurance as a benefit to its employees, but it had to pay for part of that benefit as well. And it is not an insurance company. It's not in the business of insuring people and making money by providing that insurance. So that H&H Music Company had to make a decision from its business standpoint, could it afford to continue to fund that part of the benefit program that it had, and to fund with its, with I guess its profits, that part of the benefits program that was going to carry this health insurance for these, for these employees.
But still, it made a commitment to its employees. Employees there took the job, stayed with the job, with the understanding that if they got sick, they were covered for a maximum of $1 million per lifetime.
Well, the commitment that the company had to the employees was set out in the employee benefits manual, or the summary plan description booklet, and it clearly said that the plan could change from year to year. It was terminable at any time. I think it's unfortunate. Most of us have the concept, I think, that if we have a job with a company, that we're always going to have the same employee benefits for the duration of that company. But H&H could have made the decision, for example, not to have any health insurance whatsoever, in which case there would have been no benefit for anybody to have to complain about. It could companies go out of business every day, and employees who had health insurance no longer have health insurance. So I think it's wrong, and it's probably unfortunate and dangerous for American employers and employees especially, to assume that they are always going to have insurance at the levels, you know, where they come in for employment with a company. It's not true.
Have you asked yourself how you would feel if this kind of thing happened to you?
Sure. I would probably be angry and upset, and I'm sure I would feel all the things that Mr. McGann felt. I've asked myself the question, what would it happen? What would I feel like if it happened to me today, and what can I do to prevent it? Because the problems that I face as an individual, or that you face as an individual, are probably no different than Mr. McGann insofar as insurance is concerned. I have to make a premium payment. My premiums are going up. They're going up as a result of my own family's health care claims, and they're going up as a result of the health care claims that are being experienced by the insurance company from whom I have the insurance. At some point, I have to either switch carriers because I can no longer afford the premium that I'm paying, or I have to continue to pay the premium. And you know, if I no longer have the ability to continue to pay that insurance premium, what happens to me?
Mark Huvard is a lawyer with the firm Harburg, Huvard & Bisk in Houston. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's it like to be the host of All Things Considered? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Noah Adams. He's written a new book about 1 year in the life of the show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.